Remember toilet to tap? That's the slogan often used to defeat propositions for recycling water in California. But we'll need recycling and a lot more than that, as the State Water Board has cut off all water to Central Valley farmers. California's water wars, they're still going after more than 100 years. First, what about the surge in COVID? Andy Slavik's book about last year's U.S. response is titled Preventable. He headed Medicare and Medicaid for Obama, then advised Biden on COVID. His podcast is called In the Bubble. Andy, welcome as always.
Great to be here, Warren.
There's been constantly shifting advice from the Centers for Disease Control. Now you wear a mask, even if you're vaccinated, now you don't. Now you have to wear it again. You've said on a recent podcast, you wouldn't be surprised if this back and forth continues. Are people going to get fed up with this and just somehow look the other way?
Well, let's take a step up for a second and zoom out. We have a constantly changing pandemic, and we need our government agencies to evolve with it and to help us evolve with it. So whether or not the public is frustrated or tired or confused, I'm sure different people, all of us are all of those things at various times. We do need our agencies not to look backwards, but to continue to look forward as things change. And what we have today is a different COVID-19 than we had in 2020. It spreads, you know, people can become infected if they're not vaccinated in under 5 minutes, which is much, much quicker than last year. And we have large segments of the population that aren't vaccinated. At the same time, it is possible, even if you are vaccinated, to contract a mild case. So all these facts and the fact that even vaccinated people, if they become infected, can spread COVID-19, I think all those things weigh on the CDC's decision to say, hey, you know what? It makes sense on certain occasions to wear a mask indoors, even if you're vaccinated. The same way, if it's raining out and the storm gets too bad, you don't want to have just an umbrella, but you want also a raincoat. And I think that's what they're saying.
As governments evolve, as you say, people seem to get more and more resentful and more angry at government. And the FDA hasn't yet given full approval to the vaccines. Where does that leave us?
Well, look, we have a wonderful blessing in the vaccines that we have approved by the FDA that are authorized today. They have been seen in now in billions of people across the globe, very well tolerated and highly effective. The FDA, I think, is acting rapidly, and people should understand that an EUA is only approved at a very high standard. Now, I think many people are waiting for the final authorization. It's called a BLA that will be coming, I suspect, in the next hopefully few weeks. But it's important that not be rushed, because the reason people are waiting for that authorization is because that authorization will confer the fact that the FDA has done a lot of homework, and the public trust in that homework shouldn't be sublimated to, you know, someone rushing the FDA and making them go more rapidly than they should. So I know we're all impatient, but I think this is coming soon, and I think when it comes, it will make a difference in some people's minds.
What about the politics of this, which are integral, it seems to me, to people's accepting what may be good for them? In your book, Preventable, you're scathing about Donald Trump. You work for the Biden White House. But here's President Biden saying you no longer need to wear a mask if you've been fully vaccinated. And then weeks later, he had to back away from that proclamation. How does that damage the situation as far as the president's concerned, as far as people's willingness to believe what he says is concerned?
Playing politics is a luxury of wealthy nations with abundant vaccines. And it's not a luxury that we can afford when Delta heats up. So I think it's important that we call all of our public officials to account, hold them accountable. It's important that they are able to look back at their own mistakes and do better. But, you know, I, for one, am, and even in the book, I'm very charitable to what I consider to be honest mistakes, mistakes made in the fog of war. I'm less forgiving of things that are done purposely. that I think characterize a lot of the Trump era, when he chose to try to deny that the vaccine, that the virus was even dangerous, that it even existed, that people were going to die, even when we now know he was well aware. And there's plenty of scenes and descriptions in the book that I think have come to light even more recently, and some of them based on my own interactions with Jared Kushner and others, that indicate that to even a new degree. So the most important thing for all of us right now is to, and I think you see a lot of Republicans who felt that they could spend the last few months criticizing the vaccines or even just standing on the sidelines and allowing people not to get vaccinated, you're now starting to see them come out more publicly and say, okay, now maybe we're in a situation that's beyond politics. So when the danger zone gets a little low, people play politics. I think the danger zone is high enough now that hopefully we're going to see people put the games away and start to focus on what's best for the public.
Let's hear more about the danger zone. You said the Delta virus is transmittable in under 5 minutes. Did I hear you suggest in one of your podcasts also that that may last not very long?
Well, we don't know for sure. And you know, the only people that are always regretful are the people that try to act like they're clairvoyant about what's going to come next. But what we do see is an interesting pattern. In first in India, where Delta first emerged, then in the UK, and now in Indonesia, Delta appears to spread very, very rapidly, climb to a very high case count, mostly among the unvaccinated, of course, and then peak and drop equally as quickly. That suggests that if it happens in the U.S., that places in the south, in the southern part of the U.S., could start to peak pretty soon. Now, it won't be as soon as if everybody there, if there were higher vaccination levels. The places with higher vaccination levels are going to see it much shorter. But if this is consistent, what this tells us is Delta is so contagious that it's sort of like one of those forest fires that burns quickly through the brush, and then it has no more brush. It starts to die out equally as quickly. So let's hope for that, but that's certainly not a guarantee.
Some very quick questions. What about travel, particularly overseas? Is it safe?
Well, look, I think saying safe or unsafe is a little trickier than saying high risk and low risk. And I think people's risk tolerances are always obviously quite different. For people who are vaccinated, there are many more things that they can do comfortably and safely. But it's still recommended that that if you travel, you're wearing a mask. And I think increasingly, I think people should be saying not just a mask, but an N95 or equivalent mask. And then, of course, it depends where you travel. I currently have plans to travel out of the country in October. And unless something changes where the country I'm going to is gets to be much more prevalent, or there's a new variant, or there's evidence that my vaccine is waning or something, you know, I still plan to go.
What about kids under 12?
Kids under 12 are obviously not yet eligible to be vaccinated. And I am hopeful that sometime by the end of the summer or early fall, we will change that. I think the real question around those kids is dosing. What's the dosing requirement going to need to be to do the job and not provide too much, given the size of young kids? So you know, that's going to take a little bit of time because it's a little bit more of an intricate question. I think we want to get it right. So I suspect in many places the school year will start where kids are not all fully vaccinated. And, you know, I think the right policies are that if you're not vaccinated, you wear a mask indoors. I think we obviously have some parts of the country, some states, some schools that are prohibiting that. I think that puts a real burden on parents and kids to wear a mask when others aren't. And my encouragement is if you live in that kind of location, you get together with other parents and take some collective action for all of your kids to wear masks so you can relieve some of the burden and some of the pressure on kids to be different, because kids don't like to be different. Who can blame them?
There are some reports that there have been people who have been vaccinated who have then gotten the disease. Do these vaccines really work, and are we going to need boosters?
Well, I have Albert Bourla, the CEO of Pfizer, on my podcast, this most recent episode.
I heard that, and I would urge people to listen to it. Go ahead.
Yeah, and so I ask him these very questions, and you know, people of course are free to decide whether or not they believe him. Some people do, some people don't. I know Albert. I think he's a pretty straight shooter. And what he says is that the vaccines are highly effective, even against Delta, but that effectiveness wanes over time, and that over 6 months or so, by the time you get to 6 months, the effectiveness is decreased pretty significantly at preventing kind of mild infection. The good news is that even then it sustains its ability to protect against serious infection. So look, if you are vaccinated, over time, you may face a situation where you could, if you're exposed to the virus, you'd need to be exposed for a longer period of time than someone who's unvaccinated. You could, in fact, get an infection. You could, in fact, have to miss work. But it is extremely unlikely that, unless there are other things wrong, that you would have to go to the hospital. And so the vaccines are doing the most important job they are. We're still learning about when a booster would be required. If it is, the FDA and CDC will make the decision and recommendations. My sense is, if I had to guess now, Warren, that at the very least, for people who are over 65 and or have a compromised immune system, that they will recommend a booster, and possibly they will for others. The good news also is that the U.S. government has obtained more than enough vaccines, so that if that is the case, we're prepared.
You said you don't want to make any predictions, and that's certainly understandable. On the other hand, of course, as a traveler, you're looking ahead to see what might happen in the country where you're planning to go. Can you predict at all about what's likely to happen this winter? We know there are going to be changes, of course, in the way the climate functions, and people are going to be indoors more. What do you predict, if I may ask that question?
Well, look, I think the biggest variable we have right now is actually a policy question, and that will determine, in large part, the answer to the question. And that is, do businesses and government agencies and universities kind of broadly adopt a policy which says, hey, if you're going to be in our workplace, you either have to show a negative test or be vaccinated? And, you know, we are seeing some increasing action around that, both from employers, from states, from cities, and recently from the federal government. If that, in fact, happens, I think that probably increases the percentage of people vaccinated to the point where we have closer to 80, maybe even 85% of people vaccinated. If that's the case, then, you know, I think the winter will look a little bit like sporadic small fires breaking out in places where you still have low vaccination levels, but not what we're seeing today, which is kind of a fires raging or increasing. I don't think they're raging, but increasing in every state. If that doesn't happen, then you know, you combine the winter, the flu, people's exhaustion with COVID to begin with, and lower vaccination levels, and you know, you could well see another tough winter. Now, luck plays a bigger part in this than we all want to admit. You know, the Delta variant wasn't anticipated, and the Delta variant, we will see whether or not it is just highly contagious or whether or not it has staying power and lethality. So whether or not we see yet another variant come in the fall, presuming Delta rips through before then, it's something that we can't know. And I think that's a big factor here.
Final question. Do you think that either the federal government or the states individually should mandate that people either get vaccinated or be frequently tested if they're going to be circulating among others?
So my answer is yes, but I would probably use different words to describe it, because I do think that there are a number of people who aren't vaccinated that have their reasons and their questions about it. And while, you know, I think that the case is pretty obvious, that's not the case for everybody, and people have their own reasons. So, you know, I would probably just maybe reverse it and say that that people have to demonstrate that they have a negative test twice a week, but they can waive out of that requirement if they can show proof of vaccination. And so, you know, we really emphasize to people that they do have an option, that no one's requiring them or mandating them to put anything in their body, and that that's perfectly acceptable. Because after all, what we're after is reducing the infection level. We're not after vaccination per se. We're just after getting rid of this virus.
And the bottom line is, we're going to be living with this for quite a while.
I think it's a fact of life, but Warren, I would say, you know, hopefully this soon falls into the bucket of what I would call a manageable challenge, as opposed to a state of emergency. We have lots of manageable challenges in our life. Here in Southern California, we have bad traffic. I hate the traffic. You hate the traffic. We all hate the traffic. But we don't let it turn over our life. We don't let it dominate our life. And I think we all have various things that we have to deal with, but we have the tools to deal with them. Vaccination makes this a manageable challenge. So whether or not it becomes something that pops up seasonally, or whether it's something that there's a low level of, or whether it's something we're on guard for particular people, elderly people, or people who are immunocompromised, we need to just create the tools. And we have one major tool with the vaccine. And I think should we find that our testing for an antiviral it turns out positive, as I hope it will, we'll have another great tool.
Andy Slavitt, formerly with the Obama administration, a former Biden White House advisor on COVID, podcaster at In the Bubble, as well as the author of Preventable. Thanks so much.
Great to be here.
Andy Slavitt, former Biden advisor on COVID, author of Preventable, about what doomed America's response to the pandemic, a podcaster at In the Bubble. In a moment, the drought and California's ongoing water wars on To the Point.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. This year's drought is a real threat to agriculture in California. The demand for water in the San Joaquin Valley is 16 times greater than the supply. And the State Water Board has unanimously ordered thousands of farmers to stop drawing water from the state's main streams and rivers. California's historic water wars are starting again. In a moment, we'll hear from Nusha Ajami, director of Stanford University's Water in the West program. She's got some strategies for coping with a shortage that's likely to get worse rather than better. First, here's Dan Walters. He's veteran reporter on California's water wars. They're almost as old as the state itself. Dan, welcome.
Thank you.
Legal rights to water go back more than 100 years, and now there are more legal allocations for water than there is water. You've written that titanic battles are likely in the very near future. Who are the combatants going to be? Where's the arena?
Well, there are several arenas. The legislature is one arena. Congress and the federal agencies are another arena. And, of course, the courts are always an arena when it comes to water. And in fact, the courts may be the most important arena these days because the recent moves in water, and remember, all moves in water are glacial, literally take years and decades to happen. But the most active player in recent years has been the court system as it has clamped down on diversions from the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta and said more water has to keep flowing through the Delta to support wildlife. And so the drought is on top of other things that have been going on for quite a while, but more particularly the whole conflict over how much water can be extracted from the Delta and how much water has to continue flowing through the Delta. That battle has been going on now for decades, and it was going on. And suddenly on top of that, we have our periodic droughts, not just this drought, but we get one every half decade or so. And it kind of brings all this stuff into sharp focus when there's not enough to go around.
The Delta, of course, is where the Sacramento and San Joaquin Valley rivers come together. and it's just east of San Francisco Bay. When water is diverted from the Delta, where does it go?
Well, it's diverted by the federal government and the state government in separate conveyances heading south. The California Water Project sends that water as far south as San Diego. The federal water canals go into the San Joaquin Valley to service mostly agricultural users in the San Joaquin Valley, which is a good segue into saying the one thing we always have to remember about water in California is that agriculture by far is the greatest user of human user of water as opposed to natural users of water. Domestic water, water in our taps, and even commercial water is a relatively tiny part of the water picture. When you talk about water, it begins and ends with agricultural uses and agricultural diversions. Everything else is kind of secondary or even tertiary to that fact.
California farmers, as I understand it, use three times more water than all the rest of the state, even though they're just 2% of the economy.
Actually, about four times as much. And roughly speaking, about 30 to 40 million acre feet a year, as opposed to maybe 8 or 9 million acre feet of water for other human uses. When the authorities say, take short showers, don't water your lawn and everything, yes, it has an impact, but the big impact of water is how much goes to agriculture and how much doesn't go to agriculture.
This has been true for a long time. Now we have legal marijuana in California. To what extent has marijuana, not just legally, but also by virtue of theft, had a lot to do with where the water is going?
Well, nobody really knows in terms of quantity. I suspect it's not a huge amount of, their share of the agricultural water, so to speak, is not a huge, but certainly it's irritating, particularly the illegal water diversions for illegal marijuana grows. That just kind of raises everybody's temperature. But in terms of overall quantity, my guess is probably not an awful lot in relationship to other factors.
So there's sort of a hierarchy of water rights over the years, depending on when one or another piece of land acquired or owner of land acquired the water rights. Reformers have challenged that hierarchy. What are they looking for?
Well, what they would like to do is eliminate the water rights, the pecking order of water rights in California. It's basically a chronological pecking order, depending on when you started claiming water in the first place. That's difficult. That's an extremely, it has happened in Australia, for example, but it's a very difficult thing. They've kind of edged up to the idea that those with senior water rights can be curtailed during a drought. They almost came to legal blows over that in the last drought, and it's going to happen sooner or later, because when you look at the outstanding water issues of storage, conveyance, most recently groundwater regulation, the next logical place to go if you're trying to rationalize water use in California is to do something about water rights, either to abrogate them altogether or buy them out or do something and kind of start over with a cleaner sheet of paper to allocate how water is used in California. But it would be the grandmother of all water battles. The grandmother, it's huge. When you start talking, for example, the fact that the Imperial Irrigation District, way down in the Imperial Valley on the Mexican border, controls three-fourths of the Colorado River flowing into California. Three-fourths. They're the OPEC of water because they have those senior water rights that go back more than 100 years. That's the sort of thing that kind of grates on people, that a very tiny section of the state, with a very tiny part of the economy, can control such a huge amount of water. And this is true up and down the state, but its most starkest example is the Imperial Irrigation District.
And now, of course, there's Arizona and Nevada competing for water from the Colorado River in a way that hasn't been the case, or wasn't the case, at least, until relatively recently. As promised, here is Nusha Ajami with Stanford's Water in the West program. She has served on the state Senate, or served the state Senate, I should say, and she's also been on water boards for the state and the city of San Francisco. Dr. Ajami, welcome to you.
Thank you for having me.
You've written that drought can be an opportunity. During the drought of 2018, the use of water in California actually dropped. How did that happen?
Yeah, actually, Governor Brown was a master of getting public attention on that issue. He, as you recall, he went to the mountain to measure the snow when there wasn't any snow. And, you know, a lot of reporters were there at the same time. And we got a significant coverage of that drought, which led to, and obviously he asked for voluntary water use reduction. And we noticed that some communities saved up to 20% during that period before the mandatory water use restriction went into place. So the public awareness that led by the extended media coverage, which was also impacted by the governor's political actions, was very significant and important.
So you really think he made a difference in getting people to use less water when there wasn't any snow when there was supposed to be?
I think it was just because it got people's attention. If you go out and ask people where your water is coming from and where it goes, often people really don't have any idea. So it's very hard for them to connect the drought and water shortage to what it means at their tap. Often you open your tap and water comes out. And for majority of Californians, that's true. And which means that if water is coming out, it's just hard for them to see how it relates to the drought or water shortage we're experiencing.
So people can reduce their use of water then, and they have done so when they've been acquainted with what exactly the realities are. But there are other things that can be done to make the use of water more efficient. Tell us what some of them are.
Yeah, so a couple of things to pay attention to. One is obviously we should always start from the low-hanging fruits. So conservation and efficiency are extremely important. But also there is a, you know, opportunity to kind of do more reuse and use the water multiple times at any given time, which is which brings the demand down. Another thing to, you know, sort of long-term thinking in this process is we are right now building the cities of the future. Today, we are building new, like all this new development is happening. And we should sit back and think, what does it mean? How do we need to build this homes and businesses and communities? Do we need to really actually flush down the high quality water that we have down our toilets or use it for watering our lawns? It's not just about water, but also like energy and other resources that goes to cleaning that water. So our homes can go to become much more efficient. And I agree with Dan because he mentioned about, how cities and urban areas don't use as much water. But I think it's a collective action that matters. At the end of the day, we are all agricultural water users in a way because we use the products that comes out of these farms. And reducing, food waste is also extremely important, which is quite significant. Almost 70% of our food goes to waste, and that has a significant water footprint. So it's just like one last thing I would say is, also, water quality is extremely important. Like the more we can preserve water resources to become polluted, the more water we have to use. For example, you asked about marijuana. That's an important issue because it's not just the quantity of water that's being used, but actually how it's impacting our water quality. So it's a combination of these issues that needs attention.
I have a personal reflection on the use of the reuse of water. In 1969, I was a reporter on television in Sacramento, and I reported for a Los Angeles station. And I went to South Lake Tahoe and found that they were recycling water. They were actually sending it over the mountain into Alpine County. And there was a reservoir there. And I, on camera, I drank recycled water that had been come from waste water that was in Lake Tahoe. That was in 1969. Since then, Orange County has gone a long way to recycle water. But in Los Angeles, there has been a political issue over what is referred to as toilet to tap. And it loses every time it gets on the ballot. Dan Walters, what about that? And how political is the reuse of water?
Well, it's extremely political. You mentioned Los Angeles. San Diego had a similar situation in which there were efforts to try to do this reuse of water. The Democrats, let me tell you, the Democrats excoriated the Republican city government at the time for daring to suggest such a thing. And they even rigged up a a prop of a toilet and flushing and coming back through a tap and all this kind of stuff. So they were, the Democrats were trying to use this issue against the Republicans because the Republicans were trying to reuse water. Now, which that's, is that strange or is that strange? What we've come a long way since then, one thinks, but on the other hand, it's a easy political hit to say, so-and-so wants you to drink sewage. And, it's, and as long as there's an easy political hit to be made, politicians will make the easy political hits. It's just their human nature. So you, there has to be some sort of an education program to persuade people. Think about it. We're all of us almost are drinking reused water. For example, the sewage treatment in the Sacramento area, the treated sewage in the Sacramento area, goes into the Sacramento River, flows downstream through the Delta, and is picked up and sent as far away as San Diego. They're using recycled, retreated water from Sacramento. We used to say, Derek, during one of the droughts, he says, they can't take a drink in Oakland until people flush their toilets in Sacramento. And that's actually true. So we're using this recycled water, reused water, whether we know it or not. But it still has, if you start putting in graphic terms, like toilet to tap, then it's an easy political hit, and you have to overcome that in some way.
And once again, Dr. Ajami, Orange County, at the time when it was very red, began recycling water. It does a lot of it now.
Absolutely. They actually treat the water and then put it underground. Their project started because they were using groundwater, and the seawater was intruding into the groundwater basin there. And for them to protect their groundwater basin, they started actually recycling the water and putting it underground to kind of create a barrier between the seawater and the groundwater basins they had. And then they realized, oh my God, this is another source that we can use. And they have been doing this for a long time, actually. So basically, it sits in the groundwater, and then they pull it out, treat it, put it back in the tap, and their water system, and people use it. So it has been done. And I guess one thing I would say is there are multiple levels of doing recycling, right? You can do it at house, you know, individual home level, which is sort of take the water from your shower and then use it to flush down toilets or water your lawns. Or you can do it as a at a community scale or at a city scale. I would always, when people have a hard time sort of wrapping their head around this, I think I tell them, think about solar panels. You can have a solar panel on your roof, or it can be a solar farm in your neighborhood, or on a mall's roof, or it can be a solar farm that's being put together by a city. So it's like it can come in so many different scales, and that can actually alleviate some of the water issues that we have in our communities.
And Dan Walters, back to you on a larger scale. What about the depletion of the underground aquifers particularly in the Central Valley?
Yes, well, during the last drought, we saw graphic evidence of that. During Jerry Brown's governorship, we had the drought. As you mentioned earlier, he fostered a cutback in water use. Farmers had their allocations reduced, much as they are now. Although that these current allocations are being reduced even more than they were before. At any rate, when the farmers faced those allocations, they went and started sinking wells, or they started drilling their existing wells deeper, and the depletion of the underground aquifer led to what's called subsidence. The ground is actually sinking in many of the areas of the San Joaquin Valley. Most graphically and spectacularly from a visual standpoint, a canal called the Fryant-Kern Canal that ran from the Fryant Dam down to Kern County cracked. It broke because of subsidence underneath that, and its ability to carry water was compromised tremendously. In fact, ever since then, there's been this wrangle over who's going to pay for the repairs to the Fryant-Kern Canal. So yes, it's a very serious problem, and it's that subsidence led to the groundwater regulation law that was passed a few years ago. That it's not fully implemented yet, but is actually on the books of trying to regulate groundwater, because previously there was no restrictions on what farmers could pump out of the underground aquifers. It was just kind of a Wild West scenario. So you could pump the water and your neighbor might not have any water because the water table would fall in because you pumped the water and all that kind of stuff. Anyway, we now have groundwater regulation, which was a huge, huge step in the water regulatory and management picture in California. And that's why I say the next big step is probably going to have to be water rights of some kind.
The farmers got in early when it came to establishing water rights. That's one of the reasons we have this long history of battles. Once the aquifers have been, there has been subsidence. Dan, is there any way to put the water back in?
Once, as I understand, and I'm not a hydrologist, as I understand it, once the subterranean strata have collapsed and compacted upon themselves, they lose the capacity to hold that water. And so the idea of underground recharging, which has been around for a long time, settling basins and that sort of thing, like mentioned in Orange County, it kind of goes away if there's nowhere to store that water underground, if in fact the ground has subsided. Now, it's not an either-or situation. There are areas where you could recharge, and there are areas that can no longer stand to recharge. But definitely the subsidence does impede any plans to recharge the underground water supply.
Dr. Rajami, what's your take on that? Do you think the subsidence can be overcome?
So Dan was quite right. Basically, some parts of the basin you can recover that storage; some parts you can't. The reality is depends on the soil and the geology of the location, and also when you're talking about the managed aquifer recharge or recharging groundwater, the same situation. There are some areas that are much better to recharge than others. So it really depends where we are and what you're doing, and definitely managed aquifer recharge is becoming much more serious topic in this time and age. Dan is absolutely correct. We have been talking about this for a long, long time. I personally wrote a paper 20 years ago on this, and now it's becoming such a popular topic. So it is a very important way of recovering our groundwater basins. One point I wanted to make there is, California's agriculture had been sort of shifting as well. There are so many more trees and orchards and which actually require water on a permanent basis. We used to have a lot more row crops that during the drought, we could let them let the farmers fallow the land and repurpose that water. And one of the things that we experienced during this recent drought that we had was some of those orchards and tree crops. You can't let them go. It's expensive. They need water at all times. So we saw more and more farmers digging deeper wells and trying to get as much water as they can for their crops. And I think the Groundwater Management Act that Dan mentioned, also a huge step for California. The biggest problem we are having right now is how do you monitor this water use and who is using water, where, how much, and how can you actually restrict people's water use, because the water that's under your land is sort of, it's a right that comes with your land. So there needs to be a better way of managing that resource as time goes on and we want to do more managed aquifer recharge.
And Dan, as to these new crops, one of them that people make a lot of money on and use a lot of water for is almonds.
Yeah, the almonds are a big crop. They've surged, and it's not just almonds. It's pistachios. It's also wine grapes. All require water. You can't, as mentioned, you can't let that land go foul. Now, what we are seeing, however, is as the restrictions on agricultural water become tighter and tighter and tighter, and just last week, the State Water Control Board shut down water, direct water diversions. In other words, not through canals, but people who live, the farmers along rivers who just tap the rivers, they're now under the gun to reduce their or eliminate their thing. But at any rate, what's happening is that we are seeing, in fact, almond orchards being torn up because there's no water to service them. However, I was just out on the road to San Francisco and back to for the Giants game. By the way, the Giants won. Thank you very much. yesterday, and noticed a brand new almond orchard going in right along I-80 between Sacramento and San Francisco. So even though some orchards are being ripped out, some new orchards are going in, which seems a little strange.
Dr. Rajami, what about desalination? That's one of the things being advocated, particularly on the Central Coast, which is not served by the water projects themselves. You, however, have called that something that should be just a last resort. How come?
Absolutely. I think, look, it depends where, right? I think we need to have a priority list. Start from where and where. And I think desalination often needs to be the last resort, partly because of its significant environmental footprint. Coastal California, it's beautiful and has a lot of lively ecosystem that we need to protect. And the brine that comes out of desalinating water can be can really impact taking the water from the ocean and then putting back the brine, which is like a leftover water that we don't want, the both can have a significant environmental impact wherever those desalination plants are located. This another thing is it's quite expensive compared to a lot of other things. So the technology we use for desalination is exactly the same technology we use for recycling and reuse, which means the water is pushed through this very, very fine, think about your like shirt and how fine that is, like multiple fine membranes that would just take everything out of the water and makes it clean and very clean. So that same technology can be used for other use, and actually the cost can be much less. So it's like those are some of the issues with desalination. However, I would say in Central Coast, they have done a lot. They have actually reduced their water use. They have tried to kind of explore other options. They have a recycling project that's going into they're just right now actually investing in it. So they have been trying to explore various options for dealing with their water availability and water scarcity issues. So desalination for some areas actually might be the only option left if they can't really maintain and meet their demand. And the size obviously matters. The bigger it is, the environmental impact is higher.
You've talked too about how much electricity it takes to desalinate. That's a major function, major cost. I think we've had a great conversation about what might be in store. Dr. Ajani, how bad do you think this is going to get? You're not just into hydrology, but as everybody is who deals in this, you're thinking about climate change as well. And is this going to become a permanent situation in California, effectively? And are we going to be up against it very soon?
I mean, I think we discussed this a little bit earlier, which is like we used to have these droughts that would come every decade or so. So that would give us give us a chance to for our groundwater to recover, for our systems to recover, and then we would have a few years of drought and then go back at it in another 10, 15 years. Now we are actually what we are seeing is more frequent droughts, hotter and drier droughts than we used to. I mean, we just got out of a drought in 2016-17, and now we are at it again, experiencing such significant temperatures and low water. So climate change is certainly impacting the frequency and the severity of these droughts, and that, you know, obviously, we have to rethink the way we use water. We have to rethink the way we build infrastructure. I think the question around infrastructure is very important. A lot of the infrastructure we have in California is old from the last decade. We live in a 21st century. We have to really rethink what does 21st century requires with the problems and challenges we are facing, including climate change, which is not just drought, but also floods and wildfires. All these are impacting our water in so many water systems in so many different ways. So yes, we really are under so much pressure, and we really need to rethink the way we manage our water systems and the way we build infrastructure to deal with what we are facing in this century.
Dan Walters, it sometimes seems that politicians and policymakers are behind the curve. Have they gotten this one yet?
No, I don't think so. I think it's noteworthy that even though Jerry Brown was willing to call for a 25% mandatory cutback, Gavin Newsom's been trying to actually minimize it. He called only for a 15% voluntary cut, and it doesn't seem to be... I don't think he wants to face the idea of telling people they can't water their lawns or fill their swimming pools a few weeks before a recall election. I think he just wants it to kind of let it slide a little bit until at least after that recall election. So politically, this is a hot potato. Well, I mean, we expect water to come out of the tap when we turn the handle. And anything that says that's not going to happen is political dynamite. Your example of the toilet to tap thing shows you just how touchy that issue is. It's almost a third rail sort of issue.
Okay, once again, a major crisis facing California, and some question as to whether there's going to be action in an appropriate length of time. Dan Walters, veteran reporter on California's water wars, and Nusha Ajami at Stanford University's Water in the West program. Great to have you both. Thank you very much. Come back and talk to us again, particularly after the recall election. We'll see what happens then. Thanks to you both.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Thank you very much.
The producer of To the Point is Andrea Brody. Our engineer is Chuck Previtari. You can listen again to this episode, and others are available on your favorite podcasting app. Don't forget my 6-part climate series, In Our Backyard, at kcrw.com/inourbackyard. If you want to reach us, we're on Twitter at @ToThePoint_KCRW. You can reach me directly at WarrenAlney1. Don't hesitate to let me know what you think. If you want to learn more about our guests and what we've talked about on our show, visit our webpage. Go to kcrw.com/shows. Scroll down to the Point. You'll find links and details for all of our programs in our show notes. Thanks for being with us this time. Join us again.